and if my mother hadn't happened to be looking out the kitchen window, she would not have seen him, with his jacket unzipped and his boots unlaced and his hat on crooked, mounting his bicycle with some difficulty in the icy wind. "Jesus, Hester," Noah said. "What did you do to him?"
"I know what she did to him," Simon said.
"It wasn't that," Hester said simply. "I just tickled him, and he wet his pants." She did not report this to mock Owen, and, as a testimony to my cousin's basically decent natures, the news was not greeted with their usual rowdiness, which I associated with Sawyer Depot as firmly as various forms of skiing and collision.
"The poor little guy," Simon said.
"I didn't mean to," Hester said. My mother called to me, and I had to go tell her what had happened to Owen, whereupon she made me put on my outdoor clothes while she started the car. I thought I knew the route Owen would take home, but he must have been pedaling very hard, because we did not overtake him by the gasworks on Water Street, and when we passed Dewey Street without sighting him, and there was no sign of him at Salem Street either, I began to think he had taken the Swayze Parkway out of town. And so we doubled back, along the Squamscott, but he wasn't there. We finally found him, already out of town, laboring up Maiden Hill. We slowed down when we saw his red and black wool hunter's jacket and the matching checkered cap with the ear flaps protruding, and by the time we pulled alongside him, he had run out of steam and had gotten off to walk his bicycle. He knew it was us, without looking at us, but he wouldn't stop walking. So my mother drove slowly beside him, and I rolled down the window.
"It was an accident. I just got too excited. I had too much orange juice for breakfast, and you know I can't stand being tickled," Owen said. "Nobody said anything about tickling."
"Please don't go home, Owen," my mother said.
"Everything's all right," I told him. "My cousins are very sorry."
"I peed on Hester," Owen said. "And I'm going to get in trouble at home," he said, still walking his bike at a good pace. "My father gets mad about peeing. He says I'm not a baby anymore, but sometimes I get excited."
"Owen, I'll wash and dry your clothes at our house," my mother told him. "You can wear something of Johnny's while yours are drying."
"Nothing of Johnny's will fit me," Owen said, "and I have to take a bath."
"You can take a bath at our house, Owen," I told him.
"Please come back."
"I have some outgrown things of Johnny's that will fit you, Owen," my mother said.
"Baby clothes, I suppose,"
Owen said. But he stopped walking. He leaned his head on his bike's handlebars.
"Please get in the car, Owen," my mother said.
I got out and helped him put his bicycle in the back, and then he slid into the front seat between my mother and me.
"I wanted to make a good impression because I wanted to go to Sawyer Depot," he said. "Now you'll never take me."
I found it incredible that he still wanted to go, but my mother said, "Owen, you can come with us to Sawyer Depot any time."
"Johnny doesn't want me to come,"
he told Mother, as if I weren't there in the car with them.
"It's not that, Owen," I said, "as that I thought my cousins would be too much for you."
And on the evidence of him wetting his pants, I did not say, it struck me that my cousins were too much for him.
"That was a very mild game for my cousins, Owen," I added.
"Do you think I care what they do to me?"
he shouted. He stamped his little foot on the drive shaft hump.
"Do you think I care if they start an avalanche with me?"
he screamed.
"When do I get to go anywhere? If I didn't go to school or to church or to 80 Front Street, I'd never get out of my house,"
he cried.
"If your mother didn't take me to the beach, I'd never get out of town. And I've never been to the mountains,"
he said.
"I've never even been on a train. Don't you think I might like going on a train to the mountains?"
he yelled. My mother stopped the car and hugged him and kissed him, and told him he was always welcome to come with us anywhere we went. And I rather awkwardly put my arm around him, and we just sat that way in the car. until he had composed himself sufficiently for his return to 80 Front Street, where he marched in the back door, past Lydia's room and the maids fussing in the kitchen, up the back stairs, past the maids' rooms, to my room and my bathroom, where he closed himself in and drew a deep bath. He handed me his sodden clothes, and I brought the clothes to the maids, who began their work on them. My mother knocked on the bathroom door, and looking the other way, she extended her arm into the room where Owen took a stack of my outgrown clothes from her. They were not baby clothes, as he had feared. They were just extremely small clothes.
"What shall we do with him?" Hester asked, while we were waiting for Owen to join us in the upstairs den,
or so it had been called. The den, when my grandfather was alive. It was a children's room whenever my cousins visited.
"We'll do whatever he wants," Noah said.
"That's what we did the last time,"
Simon said.
"Not quite," Hester said.
"Well, I've been thinking,"
Owen said when he walked into the den, even pinker than usual. He was spanking clean, as they say, with his hair slicked back. In his stocking feet, he was slipping a little on the hardwood floor, and when he reached the old Oriental, he stood with one foot balanced on top of the other, twisting his hips back and forth as he talked, his hands like butterflies, flitting up and down between his waist and his shoulders.
"I apologize for becoming overexcited. I think I know a game that would not be quite as exciting for me, but at the same time I think it would not be boring for you," he said. "You see, one of you gets to hide me. Somewhere, it could be anywhere. And the others have to find me. And whoever can find a place to hide me that takes the longest time for the others to find me, whoever that is, wins. You see, it's pretty easy to find places in this house to hide me because this house is huge and I'm small,"
Owen said.
"I go first," Hester said. "I get to hide him first."
No one argued. Wherever she hid him, we never found him. Noah and Simon and I, we thought it would be easy to find him. I knew every inch of my grandmother's house, and Noah and Simon knew almost everything about Hester's diabolical mind. But we couldn't find him. Hester stretched out on the couch in the den, looking at old issues of Life magazine, growing more and more content as we searched and searched and darkness fell. I even expressed to Hester my concern that she had put Owen somewhere where he might have run out of air, or, as the hours dragged on, where he would suffer severe cramps from having to maintain an uncomfortable position. But Hester dismissed these concerns with a wave of her hand, and when it was supper time, we had to give up. Hester made us wait in the downstairs front hall, and she went and got Owen, who was very happy and walking without a limp, and breathing without difficulty, although his hair looked slept on. He stayed for supper, and he told me after we'd eaten that he wouldn't mind staying overnight, too. My mother invited him to stay, because, she said, his clothes hadn't completely dried. And although I asked him,
"Where'd she hide you? Just give me a clue. Tell me what part of the house. Just tell me which floor,"
he wouldn't disclose his triumph. He was wide awake and in no mood to sleep, and he was irritatingly philosophic regarding the true character of my cousins, whom he said I had failed to present fairly to him.
"You have really misjudged them,"
he lectured me.
"Perhaps what you call their wildness is just a matter of lack of direction. Someone has to give any group of people direction, you know?"
I lay there thinking I couldn't wait until he came to Sawyer Depot, and my cousins got him on skis and simply pointed him downhill. That might shut him up about providing adequate direction. But there was no turning him off. He just babbled on and on. I got drowsy and turned my back to him, and therefore I was confused when I heard him say,
"It's hard to go to sleep without it, once you get used to it, isn't it?"
"Without what?" I asked him.
"Used to what, Owen?"
"The armadillo," he said.
And so that day after Thanksgiving, when Owen Meany met my cousins, provided me with two very powerful images of Owen, especially on the night I tried to get to sleep after the foul ball had killed my mother. I lay in bed, knowing that Owen would be thinking about my mother, too, and that he would be thinking not only of me, but also of Dan Needham, of how much we both would miss her. And if Owen was thinking of Dan, I knew that he would be thinking about the armadillo, too. It was also important. That day, when my mother and I chased after Owen in the car, and I saw the posture of his body jerking on his bicycle, trying to pedal up Maiden Hill, and I saw how he faltered and had to get off the bike and walk it the rest of the way. That day provided me with a cold-weather picture of how Owen must have looked on that warm summer evening when he was struggling home after the Little League game, with his baseball uniform plastered to his back. What was he going to tell his parents about the game? It would take years for me to remember the decision regarding whether I should spend the night after that fatal game with Dan Needham in the apartment that he and my mother had moved into with me after they'd married. It was a faculty apartment in one of the academy dormitories, or whether I would be more comfortable spending that terrible night back in my old room in my grandmother's house at 80 Front Street. So many of the details surrounding that game would take years to remember. Anyway, Dan Needham and my grandmother agreed that it would be better for me to spend the night at 80 Front Street, and so, in addition to the disorientation of waking up the next morning after very little sleep and gradually realizing that the dream of my mother being killed by a baseball that Owen Meany hit was not a dream, I faced the further disorientation of not immediately knowing where I was. It was very much like waking up as a kind of traveler in science fiction, someone who had traveled back in time, because I had grown used to waking up in my room in Dan Needham's apartment. And as if all this weren't sufficiently bewildering, there was a noise I had never before associated with 80 Front Street. It was a noise in the driveway, and my bedroom windows didn't face the driveway, so I had to get out of bed and leave my room to see what the noise was. I was pretty sure I knew. I had heard that noise many times at the Meany Granite Quarry. It was the unmistakable, very lowest gear of the huge flatbed hauler, the truck Mr. Meany used to carry the granite slabs, the curbstones and cornerstones and the monuments. And sure enough, the Meany Granite Company truck was in my grandmother's driveway, taking up the whole driveway, and it was loaded with granite and gravestones. I could easily imagine my grandmother's indignation if she was up and saw the truck there. I could just hear her saying, "How incredibly tasteless of that man. My daughter not dead a day, and what is he doing, giving us a tombstone? I suppose he's already carved the letters." That is actually what I thought. But Mr. Meany did not get out of the cab of his truck. It was Owen who got out on the passenger side, and he walked around to the rear of the flatbed and removed several large cartons from the rest of the load. The cartons were clearly not full of granite, or Owen would not have been able to lift them off by himself. But he managed this and brought all the cartons to the step by the back door, where I was sure he was going to ring the bell. I could still hear his voice saying, "I'm sorry," while my head was hidden under Mr. Chickering's warm-up jacket. And as much as I wanted to see Owen, I knew I would burst into tears as soon as he spoke, or as soon as I had to speak to him. And therefore, I was relieved when he didn't ring the bell. He left the cartons at the back door and ran quickly to the cab, and Mr. Meany drove the granite truck out of the driveway, still in the very lowest gear. In the cartons were all of Owen's baseball cards, his entire collection. My grandmother was appalled, but for several years she didn't understand Owen or appreciate him. To her, he was that boy, or that little guy, or that voice. I knew the baseball cards were Owen's favorite things. They were what amounted to his treasure. I could instantly identify with how everything connected to the game of baseball had changed for him, as it had changed for me, although I'd never loved the game as Owen had loved it. I knew without speaking to Owen that neither of us would ever play Little League ball again, and that there was some necessary ritual ahead of us both, wherein we would need to throw away our bats and gloves and uniforms and every stray baseball there was to be found around our houses and yards, except for that baseball, which I suspected Owen had relegated to a museum piece status. But I needed to talk to Dan Needham about the baseball cards, because they were Owen's most prized possessions, indeed his only prized possessions, and since my mother's accident had made baseball a game of death, what did Owen want me to do with his baseball cards? Did they merely represent how he was washing his hands of the great American pastime, or did he want me to assuage my grief by indulging in the pleasure I would derive from burning all those baseball cards? On that day, it would have been a pleasure to burn them. "He wants you to give them back," Dan Needham said. I knew from the first that my mother had picked a winner when she picked Dan. But it was not until the day after my mother's death that I knew she'd picked a smart man, too. Of course, that's what Owen expected of me. He gave me his baseball cards to show me how sorry he was about the accident and how much he was hurting, too. Because Owen had loved my mother almost as much as I did, I was sure, and to give me all his cards was his way of saying that he loved me enough to trust me with his famous collection. But naturally, he wanted all the cards back. Dan Needham said, "Let's look at a few of them. I'll bet they're all in some kind of order, even in these boxes." And yes, they were. Dan and I couldn't figure out the exact rules under which they were ordered, but the cards were organized under an extreme system. They were alphabetized by the names of players, but the hitters, I mean the big hitters, were alphabetized in a group of their own. And your golden glove type fielders, they had a category all to themselves too, and the pitchers were all together. There even seemed to be some sub-indexing related to the age of the players, but Dan and I found it difficult to look at the cards for very long. So many of the players faced the camera with their lethal bats resting confidently on their shoulders. I know many people today who instinctively cringe at any noise even faintly resembling a gunshot or an exploding bomb. A car backfires, the handle of a broom or a shovel whacks flat against a cement or a linoleum floor. A kid detonates a firecracker in an empty trash can, and my friends cover their heads, primed, as we all are today, for the terrorist attack or the random assassin. But not me, and never Owen Meany. All because of one badly played baseball game, one unlucky swing, and the most unlikely contact. All because of one lousy foul ball among millions. Owen Meany and I were permanently conditioned to flinch at the sound of a different kind of gunshot, that much-loved and most American sound of summer, the good old crack of the bat. And so, as I often would, I took Dan Needham's advice. We loaded the cartons of Owen's baseball cards into the car, and we tried to think of the least conspicuous time of day when we could drive out to the Meany Granite Quarry, when we would not necessarily need to greet Mr. Meany or disturb Mrs. Meany's grim profile in any of the several windows or actually need to talk with Owen. Dan understood that I loved Owen and that I wanted to talk with him, most of all, but that it was a conversation for both Owen's sake and mine that was best to delay. But before we finished loading the baseball cards in the car, Dan Needham asked me, "What are you giving him?" "What?" I said. "To show him that you love him," Dan Needham said. "That's what he was showing you. What have you got to give him?" Of course I knew what I had that would show Owen that I loved him. I knew what my armadillo meant to him. But it was a little awkward to give Owen the armadillo in front of Dan Needham, who'd given it to me. And what if Owen didn't give it back? I'd needed Dan's help to understand that I was supposed to return the damn baseball cards. What if Owen decided he was supposed to keep the armadillo?
The main thing is, Johnny, Dan Needham said, you have to show Owen that you love him enough to trust anything with him, to not care if you do or don't get it back. It's got to be something he knows you want back. That's what makes it special.
Suppose I give him the armadillo, I said. Suppose he keeps it.
Dan Needham sat down on the front bumper of the car. It was a Buick station wagon, forest green, with real wooden panels on the sides and on the tailgate, and a chrome grille that looked like the gaping mouth of a voracious fish. From where Dan was sitting, the Buick appeared ready to eat him, and Dan looked tired enough to be eaten without much of a struggle. I'm sure he'd been up crying all night like me, and unlike me, he'd probably been up drinking, too. He looked awful. But he said very patiently and very carefully, Johnny, I would be honored if anything I gave you could actually be used for something important. If it were to have any special purpose, I'd be very proud. That was when I first began to think about certain events or specific things being important and having special purpose. Until then, the notion that anything had a designated, much less a special, purpose would have been cuckoo to me. I was not what was commonly called a believer then, and I am a believer now. I believe in God, and I believe in the special purpose of certain events or specific things. I observe all holy days, which only the most old-fashioned Anglicans call red-letter days. It was a red-letter day, fairly recently, when I had reason to think of Owen Meany. It was January 25, 1987, when the lessons proper for the conversion of St. Paul reminded me of Owen. The Lord says to Jeremiah, Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you, and before you were born, I consecrated you. I appointed you a prophet to the nations. But Jeremiah says he doesn't know how to speak. He's only a youth, Jeremiah says. Then the Lord straightens him out about that. The Lord says, Do not say, I am only a youth, for to all to whom I send you, you shall go, and whatever I command you, you shall speak. Be not afraid of them, for I am with you to deliver you, says the Lord. Then the Lord touches Jeremiah's mouth and says, Behold, I have put my words in your mouth. See, I have set you this day over nations and over kingdoms, to pluck up and to break down, to destroy and to overthrow, to build and to plant. It is on red-letter days especially that I think about Owen. Sometimes I think about him too intensely, and that's usually when I skip a Sunday service or two, and I try not to pick up my prayer book for a while. I suppose the conversion of St. Paul has a special effect on a convert like me. And how can I not think of Owen when I read Paul's letter to the Galatians, that part where Paul says, And I was still not known by sight to the churches of Christ in Judea. They only heard it said, He who once persecuted us is now preaching the faith he once tried to destroy, and they glorified God because of me. How well I know that feeling. I trust in God because of Owen Meany. It was because I trusted Dan Needham that I gave the armadillo to Owen. I put it in a brown paper bag, which I put inside another brown paper bag, and although I had no doubt that Owen would know exactly what it was before he opened the bags, I gave brief consideration to how shocked his mother might be if she opened the bags, but it was not her business to open the bags, I figured. Owen and I were 11. We had no other way to articulate what we felt about what had happened to my mother. He gave me his baseball cards, but he really wanted them back, and I gave him my stuffed armadillo, which I certainly hoped he'd give back to me. All because it was impossible for us to say to each other how we really felt. How did it feel to hit a ball that hard and then realize that the ball had killed your best friend's mother? How did it feel to see my mother sprawled in the grass and to have the moronic chief of police complain about the missing baseball and calling that stupid ball the instrument of death and the murder weapon? Owen and I couldn't have talked about those things, at least not then. So we gave each other our best-loved possessions and hoped to get them back. When you think of it, that's not so silly. By my calculations, Owen was a day late returning the armadillo. He kept it overnight for 2 nights, which in my view was 1 night too many. But he did return it. Once again, I heard the lowest possible gear of the granite truck. Once again, there was an early morning drop-off at 80 Front Street before Mr. Meany went ahead with the rest of the day's heavy business. And there were the same brown paper bags that I had used on the step by the back door. It was a little dangerous to leave the armadillo outside on the step, I thought, given the indiscriminate appetites of that certain Labrador retriever belonging to our neighbor Mr. Fish. Then I remembered that Sagamore was dead. But my greatest indignation was to follow. Missing from the armadillo were the little animal's front claws, the most useful and impressive parts of its curious body. Owen had returned the armadillo, but he'd kept the claws. Well, friendship being one thing and the armadillo quite another, I was so outraged by this discovery that I needed to talk to Dan Needham. As always, Dan made himself available. He sat on the edge of my bed while I sniveled. Without its claws, the beast could no longer stand upright, not without pitching forward and resting on its snout. There was virtually no position I could find for the armadillo that did not make the creature resemble a supplicant, not to mention a wretched amputee. I was quite upset at how my best friend could have done this to me, until Dan Needham informed me that this was precisely what Owen felt he had done to me and to himself, that we were both maimed and mutilated by what had happened to us. "Your friend is most original," Dan Needham said, with the greatest respect. "Don't you see, Johnny? If he could, he would cut off his hands for you. That's how it makes him feel to have touched that baseball bat, to have swung that bat with those results. It's how we all feel, you and me and Owen. We've lost a part of ourselves." And Dan picked up the wrecked armadillo and began to experiment with it on my night table, trying, as I had tried, to find a position that allowed the beast to stand or even to lie down with any semblance of comfort or dignity. It was quite impossible. The thing had been crippled. It was rendered an invalid. And how had Owen arranged the claws, I wondered. What sort of terrible altarpiece had he constructed? Were the claws gripping the murderous baseball? And so Dan and I became quite emotional, while we struggled to find a way to make the armadillo's appearance acceptable. But that was the point, Dan concluded. There was no way that any or all of this was acceptable. What had happened was unacceptable. Yet we still had to live with it. "It's brilliant, really. It's absolutely original," Dan kept muttering, until he fell asleep on the other twin bed in my room where Owen had spent so many nights, and I covered him up and let him sleep. When my grandmother came to kiss me goodnight, she kissed Dan goodnight, too. Then, in the weak glow from the nightlight, I discovered that by opening the shallow drawer under the top of the night table, I could position the armadillo in such a way that it was possible for me to imagine it was something else. Half in and half out of the drawer, the armadillo resembled a kind of aquatic creature. It was all head and torso. I could imagine that those were some sort of stunted flippers protruding where its claws had been. Just before I fell asleep, I realized that everything Dan had said about Owen's intentions was correct. How much it has meant to my life that Dan Needham was almost never wrong. I was not as familiar with Wall's History of Gravesend as I became when I was 18 and read the whole thing for myself, but I was familiar with those parts of it that Owen Meany considered important. And just before I fell asleep, I also recognized my armadillo for what it was, in addition to all those things Dan had told me. My armadillo had been amputated to resemble Wadahantowit's totem, the tragic and mysterious armless man. For weren't the Indians wise enough to understand that everything had its own soul, its own spirit? It was Owen Meany who told me that only white men are vain enough to believe that human beings are unique because we have souls. According to Owen, Wadahantowit knew better. Wadahantowit believed that animals had souls, and that even the much-abused Squamscott River had a soul. Wadahantowit knew that the land he sold to my ancestors was absolutely full of spirits. The rocks they had to move to plant a field, they were, forever after, restless and displaced spirits. And the trees they cut down to build their homes, they had a different spirit from the spirits that escaped those houses as the smoke from firewood. Wadahantowit may have been the last resident of Gravesend, New Hampshire, who really understood what everything cost. Here, take my land. There go my arms. It would take me years to learn everything that Owen Meany was thinking, and I didn't understand him very well that night. Now I know that the armadillo told me what Owen was thinking, although Owen himself would not until we were both students at Gravesend Academy. It wasn't until then that I realized Owen had already conveyed his message to me via the armadillo. Here is what Owen Meany and the armadillo said.
God has taken your mother. My hands were the instrument. God has taken my hands. I am God's instrument.
How could it ever have occurred to me that a fellow 11-year-old was thinking any such thing? That Owen Meany was a chosen one was the furthest thing from my mind. That Owen could even consider himself one of God's appointed would have been a surprise to me. To have seen him up in the air at Sunday school, you would not have thought he was at work on God's assignment. And you must remember, forgetting about Owen, that at the age of 11 I did not believe there were chosen ones, or that God appointed anyone, or that God gave assignments. As for Owen's belief that he was God's instrument, I didn't know that there was other evidence upon which Owen was basing his conviction that he'd been specially selected to carry out the work of the Lord. But Owen's idea that God's reasoning was somehow predetermining Owen's every move came from much more than that one unlucky swing and crack of the bat, as you shall see. Today, January 30th, 1987. It is snowing in Toronto. In the dog's opinion, Toronto is improved by snow. I enjoy walking the dog when it's snowing because the dog's enthusiasm is infectious. In the snow, the dog establishes his territorial rights to the St. Clair Reservoir as if he were the first dog to relieve himself there. An illusion that is made possible by the fresh snow covering the legion of dog turds for which the St. Clair Reservoir is famous. In the snow, the clock tower of Upper Canada College appears to preside over a preparatory school in a small New England town. When it's not snowing, the cars and buses on the surrounding roads are more numerous, the sounds of traffic are less muted, and the presence of downtown Toronto seems closer. In the snow, the view of the clock tower of Upper Canada College, especially from the distance of Kilberry Road or closer from the end of Frybrook Road, reminds me of the clock tower of the main academy building in Gravesend, fastidious, sepulchral. In the snow, there is something almost like New England about where I live on Russell Hill Road. Granted, Torontonians do not favor white-clappered houses with dark green or black shutters, but my grandmother's house at 80 Front Street was brick. Torontonians prefer brick and stone. Inexplicably, Torontonians clutter their brick and stone houses with too much trim, or with window trim and shutters, and they also carve their shutters with hearts or maple leaves. But the snow conceals these frills, and on some days, like today, when the snow is especially wet and heavy, the snow turns even the brick houses white. Toronto is sober, but not austere. Gravesend is austere, but also pretty. Toronto is not pretty, but in the snow, Toronto can look like Gravesend, both pretty and austere. And from my bedroom window on Russell Hill Road, I can see both Grace Church on the hill and the Bishop Strawn Chapel. How fitting that a boy whose childhood was divided by two churches should live out his present life in view of two more. But this suits me now. Both churches are Anglican. The cold gray stones of both Grace Church and the Bishop Strawn School are also improved by snow. My grandmother liked to say that snow was healing, that it healed everything. A typical Yankee point of view. If it snows a lot, snow must be good for you. In Toronto, it's good for me. And the little children sledding at the St. Clair Reservoir, they remind me of Owen, too. Because I have fixed Owen at a permanent size, which is the size he was when he was 11, which was the size of an average 5-year-old. But I should be careful not to give too much credit to the snow. There are so many things that remind me of Owen. I avoid American newspapers and magazines and American television and other Americans in Toronto, but Toronto is not far enough away. Just the day before yesterday, January 28, 1987, the front page of the Globe and Mail gave us a full account of President Ronald Reagan's State of the Union message. Will I ever learn? When I see such things, I know I should simply not read them. I should pick up the Book of Common Prayer instead. I should not give in to anger. But God forgive me, I read the State of the Union message. After almost 20 years in Canada, there are certain American lunatics who still fascinate me. There must be no Soviet beachhead in Central America, President Reagan said. He also insisted that he would not sacrifice his proposed nuclear missiles in space, his beloved Star Wars plan, to a nuclear arms agreement with the Soviet Union. He even said that a key element of the U.S.-Soviet agenda is more responsible Soviet conduct around the world, as if the United States were a bastion of responsible conduct around the world. I believe that President Reagan can say these things only because he knows that the American people will never hold him accountable for what he says. It is history that holds you accountable, and I've already expressed my opinion that Americans are not big on history. How many of them even remember their own recent history? Was 20 years ago so long ago for Americans? Do they remember October 21st, 1967? 50,000 anti-war demonstrators were in Washington. I was there. That was the March on the Pentagon, remember? And 2 years later, in October of 69, there were 50,000 people in Washington again. They were carrying flashlights. They were asking for peace. There were 100,000 asking for peace in Boston Common. There were 250,000 in New York. Ronald Reagan had not yet numbed the United States, but he had succeeded in putting California to sleep. He described the Vietnam protests as giving aid and comfort to the enemy. As president, he still didn't know who the enemy was. I now believe that Owen Meany always knew. He knew everything. We were seniors at Gravesend Academy in February of 1962. We watched a lot of TV at 80 Front Street. President Kennedy said that U.S. advisors in Vietnam would return fire if fired upon.
"I hope we're advising the right guys," Owen Meany said.
That spring, less than a month before Gravesend Academy's graduation exercises, the TV showed us a map of Thailand. 5,000 U.S. Marines and 50 jet fighters were being sent there in response to communist expansion in Laos, President Kennedy said.
"I hope we know what we're doing," said Owen Meany.
In the summer of 63, the summer following our first year at the university, the Buddhists in Vietnam were demonstrating. There were revolts. Owen and I saw our first self-immolation on television. South Vietnamese government forces, led by Ngo Dinh Diem, the elected president, attacked several Buddhist pagodas. That was in August. In May, Diem's brother, Ngo Dinh Nu, who ran the secret police force, had broken up a Buddhist celebration by killing 8 children and 1 woman.
"Diem is a Catholic," Owen Meany announced. "What's a Catholic doing as president of a country of Buddhists?"
That was the summer that Henry Cabot Lodge became the U.S. ambassador to Vietnam. That was the summer that Lodge received a State Department cable advising him that the United States would no longer tolerate Ngo Dinh Nu's influence on President Diem's regime. In 2 months, a military coup toppled Diem's South Vietnamese government. The next day, Diem and his brother Nu were assassinated.
"It looks like we've been advising the wrong guys," Owen said.
And the next summer, when we saw on TV the North Vietnamese patrol boats in the Tonkin Gulf, within 2 days they attacked 2 U.S. destroyers, Owen said,
"Do we think this is a movie?"
President Johnson asked Congress to give him the power to take all necessary measures to repel an armed attack against the forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression. The Tonkin Gulf Resolution was approved by the House by a unanimous vote of 416-0. It passed the Senate by a vote of 88-2. But Owen Meany asked my grandmother's television set a question.
"Does that mean the president can declare a war without declaring it?"
That New Year's Eve, I remember that Hester drank too much. She was throwing up. There were barely more than 20,000 U.S. military personnel in Vietnam, and only a dozen or so had been killed. By the time the Congress put an end to the Tonkin Gulf Resolution in May of 1970, there had been more than 500,000 U.S. military personnel in Vietnam, and more than 40,000 of them were dead. As early as 1965, Owen Meany detected a problem of strategy. In March, the U.S. Air Force began Operation Rolling Thunder to strike targets in North Vietnam to stop the flow of supplies to the south, and the first American combat troops landed in Vietnam.
"There's no end to this," Owen said. "There's no good way to end it."
On Christmas Day, President Johnson suspended Operation Rolling Thunder. He stopped the bombing. In a month, the bombing began again, and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee opened their televised hearings on the war. That was when my grandmother started paying attention. In the fall of 1966, Operation Rolling Thunder was said to be closing in on Hanoi, but Owen Meany said,
"I think Hanoi can handle it."
Do you remember Operation Tiger Hound? How about Operation Masher, White Wing, Thong Phong 2? That one produced 2,389 known enemy casualties. And then there was Operation Paul Revere, Thong Phong 14. not quite so successful, only 546 known enemy casualties. And how about Operation Meng Ho 6? There were 6,161 known enemy casualties. By New Year's Eve 1966, a total of 6,644 U.S. military had been killed in action. It was Owen Meany who remembered that was 483 more casualties than the enemy had suffered in Operation Meng Ho.
"How do you remember such things, Owen?" my grandmother asked him.
From Saigon, General Westmoreland was asking for fresh manpower. Owen remembered that, too. According to the State Department, according to Dean Rusk, remember him? We were winning a war of attrition.
"That's not the kind of war we win," said Owen Meany.
By the end of 67, there were 500,000 U.S. military personnel in Vietnam. That was when General Westmoreland said, "We have reached an important point where the end begins to come into view."
"What end?" Owen Meany asked the general. "What happened to the fresh manpower? Remember the fresh manpower?"
I now believe that Owen remembered everything. A part of knowing everything is remembering everything. Do you remember the Tet Offensive? That was in January of 68. Tet is a traditional Vietnamese holiday, the equivalent of our Christmas and New Year's, and it was usual, during the Vietnam War, to observe a ceasefire for the holiday season. But that year, the North Vietnamese attacked more than 100 South Vietnamese towns, more than 30 provincial capitals. That was the year President Johnson announced that he would not seek re-election. Remember? That was the year Robert Kennedy was assassinated. You might recall that. That was the year Richard Nixon was elected president. Maybe you remember him. In the following year, in 1969, the year when Ronald Reagan described the Vietnam protests as giving aid and comfort to the enemy, there were still 500,000 Americans in Vietnam. I was never one of them. More than 30,000 Canadians served in Vietnam, too, and almost as many Americans came to Canada during the Vietnam War. I was one of them, one who stayed. By March of 1971, when Lieutenant William Calley was convicted of premeditated murder, I was already a landed immigrant. I'd already applied for Canadian citizenship. It was Christmas, 1972, when President Nixon bombed Hanoi. That was an 11-day attack, employing more than 40,000 tons of high explosives. As Owen had said, Hanoi could handle it. What did he ever say that wasn't right? I remember what he said about Abby Hoffman, for example. Remember Abby Hoffman? He was the guy who tried to levitate the Pentagon off its foundations. He was quite a clown. He was the guy who created the Youth International Party, the Yippies. He was very active in anti-war protests, while at the same time he conceived of a meaningful revolution as roughly anything that conveyed irreverence with comedy and vulgarity.
"Who does this jerk think he's helping?" Owen said.
It was Owen Meany who kept me out of Vietnam, a trick that only Owen could have managed.
"Just think of this as my little gift to you."
That was how he put it. It makes me ashamed to remember that I was angry with him for taking my armadillo's claws. God knows, Owen gave me more than he ever took from me. Even when you consider that he took my mother. Chapter 3. The Angel. In her bedroom at 80 Front Street, my mother kept a dressmaker's dummy. It stood at attention next to her bed, like a servant about to awaken her, like a sentry guarding her while she slept, like a lover about to get into bed beside her. My mother was good at sewing. In another life, she could have been a seamstress. Her taste was quite uncomplicated, and she made her own clothes. Her sewing machine, which she also kept in her bedroom, was a far cry from the antique that we children abused in the attic. Mother's machine was a strikingly modern piece of equipment, and it got a lot of use. For all those years before she married Dan Needham, my mother never had a real job or pursued a higher education, and although she never lacked money, because my grandmother was generous to her, she was clever at keeping her personal expenses to a minimum. She would bring home some of the loveliest clothes from Boston, but she would never buy them. She dressed up her dressmaker's dummy in them, and she copied them. Then she'd return the originals to the various Boston stores. She said she always told them the same thing, and they never got angry at her. Instead, they felt sorry for her and took the clothes back without an argument. "My husband doesn't like it," she'd tell them. She would laugh to my grandmother and me about it. "They must think I'm married to a real tyrant. He doesn't like anything." My grandmother, keenly aware that my mother wasn't married at all, would laugh uncomfortably at this, but it seemed such a solitary and innocent piece of mischief that I'm sure Harriet Wheelwright did not object to her daughter having a little fun. And Mother made beautiful clothes, simple, as I've described. Most of them were white or black, but they were made of the best material, and they fitted her perfectly. The dresses and blouses and skirts she brought home were multicolored and multi-patterned, but my mother would expertly imitate the cut of the clothes in basic black and white. As in many things, my mother could be extremely accomplished without being in the least original or even inventive. The game she acted out upon the perfect body of the dressmaker's dummy must have pleased the frugal, Yankee part of her, the Wheelwright in her. My mother hated darkness. There could never be enough light to suit her. I saw the dummy as a kind of accomplice to my mother in her war against the night. She would close her curtains only when she was undressing for bed. When she had her nightgown and her robe on, she would open the curtains. When she turned out the lamp on her bedside table, whatever light there was in the night flooded into her room, and there was always some light. There were street lights on Front Street. Mr. Fish left lights on in his house all night, and my grandmother left a light on. It pointlessly illuminated the garage doors. In addition to this neighborhood light, there was starlight or moonlight or that unnameable light that comes from the eastern horizon whenever you live near the Atlantic coast. There was not a night when my mother lay in her bed unable to see the comforting figure of the dressmaker's dummy. It was not only her confederate against the darkness, it was her double. It was never naked. I don't mean that my mother was so crazy about sewing that there was always a dress in progress upon the dummy. Whether out of a sense of decency or a certain playfulness that my mother had not outgrown from whenever it was that she used to dress up her dolls, the dummy was always dressed. And I don't mean casually. Mother would never allow the dummy to stand around in a slip. I mean that the dummy was always completely dressed, and well-dressed, too. I remember waking up from a nightmare, or waking up and feeling sick, and going down the dark hall from my room to hers, feeling my way to her doorknob. Once in her room, I sensed that I had traveled to another time zone. After the darkness of my room and the black hall, my mother's room glowed. By comparison to the rest of the house, it was always just before dawn in my mother's room. And there would be the dummy, dressed for real life, dressed for the world. Sometimes I would think the dummy was my mother, that she was already out of bed and on her way to my room. Possibly she'd heard me coughing or crying out in my sleep. Perhaps she got up early, or maybe she was just coming home very late. Other times, the dummy would startle me. I would have forgotten all about it, and in the gray half-light of that room I would think it was an assailant, for a figure standing so still beside a sleeping body could as easily be an attacker as a guard. The point is, it was my mother's body, exactly. It can make you look twice, Dan Needham used to say. Dan told some stories about the dummy after he married my mother. When we moved into Dan's dormitory apartment at Gravesend Academy, the dummy and my mother's sewing machine became permanent residents of the dining room, which we never once ate in. We ate most of our meals in the school dining hall, and when we did eat at home, we ate in the kitchen. Dan tried sleeping with the dummy in the bedroom only a few times. "Tabby, what's wrong?" he asked it the first night, thinking my mother was up. "Come back to bed," he said another time, and once he asked the dummy, "Are you ill?" And my mother, not quite asleep beside him, murmured, "No, are you?" Of course, it was Owen Meany who experienced the most poignant encounters with my mother's dummy. Long before Dan Needham's armadillo changed Owen's and my life, a game that Owen enjoyed at 80 Front Street involved dressing and undressing my mother's dummy. My grandmother frowned upon this game, on the basis that we were boys. My mother, in turn, was wary. At first, she feared for her clothes, but she trusted us. We had clean hands, we returned dresses and blouses and skirts to their proper hangers, and her lingerie properly folded to its correct drawers. My mother grew so tolerant of our game that she even complimented us, on occasion, for the creation of an outfit she hadn't thought of. And several times, Owen was so excited by our creation that he begged my mother to model the unusual combination herself. Only Owen Meany could make my mother blush. "I've had this old blouse and this old skirt for years," she would say. "I just never thought of wearing them with this belt. You're a genius, Owen," she'd tell him.
"But everything looks good on you,"
Owen would tell her, and she'd blush. If Owen had wanted to be less flattering, he might have remarked that it was easy to dress my mother or her dummy because all her clothes were black and white. Everything went with everything else. There was that one red dress, and we could never find a way to make her like it. It was never meant to be a part of her wardrobe, but I believed the wheelwright and my mother made it impossible for her to give or throw the dress away. She'd found it in an exceptionally posh Boston store. She loved the clingy material, its scooped back, its fitted waist and full skirt. But she hated the color, a scarlet red, a poinsettia red. She'd meant to copy it, in white or in black, like all the others. But she liked the cut of the dress so much that she copied it in white and in black. "White for a tan," she said, "and black in the winter." When she went to Boston to return the red dress, she said she discovered the store had burned to the ground. For a while, she couldn't remember the store's name, but she asked people in the neighborhood. She wrote to the former address. There was some crisis with insurance, and it was months before she finally got to talk with someone, and then it was only a lawyer. "But I never paid for the dress," my mother said. "It was very expensive. I was just trying it out, and I don't want it. I don't want to be billed for it months later. It was very expensive," she repeated. But the lawyer said it didn't matter. Everything was burned. Bills of sale were burned. Inventory was burned. Stock was burned. "The telephone melted," he said. "The cash register melted," he added. "That dress is the least of their problems. It's your dress," the lawyer said. "You got lucky," he told her, in a way that made her feel guilty.
"Good heavens," my grandmother said. "It's so easy to make wheelwrights feel guilty. Get hold of yourself, Tabitha, and stop complaining. It's a lovely dress. It's a Christmas color," my grandmother decided. "There are always Christmas parties. It will be perfect."
But I never saw my mother take the dress out of her closet. The only way that dress ever found its way to the dressmaker's dummy, after my mother had copied it, was when Owen dressed the dummy in it. Not even Owen could find a way to make my mother like that red dress.
It may be a Christmas color, she said, but I'm the wrong color, especially at Christmas time, in that dress. She meant she looked sallow in red when she didn't have a tan, and who in New Hampshire has a tan for Christmas?
Then wear it in the summer, Owen suggested.
But it was a show-off thing to wear such a bright red color in the summer. That was making too much of a tan, in my mother's opinion. Dan suggested that my mother donate the red dress to his seedy collection of stage costumes. But my mother thought that was wasteful, and besides, none of the Gravesend Academy boys, and certainly no other woman from our town, had the figure to do that dress justice. Dan Needham not only took over the dramatic performances of the Gravesend Academy boys, he revitalized the amateur theatrical company of our small town, the formerly lackluster Gravesend Players. Dan talked everyone into the Gravesend Players. He got half the faculty at the academy to bring out the hams in themselves, and he roused the histrionic natures of half the townspeople by inviting them to try out for his productions. He even got my mother to be his leading lady, if only once. As much as my mother liked to sing, she was extremely shy about acting. She agreed to be in only one play, under Dan's direction, and I think she agreed only as an indication of her commitment to their prolonged courtship, and only if Dan was cast opposite her, if he was the leading man, and if he was not cast as her lover. She didn't want the town imagining all sorts of things about their courtship, she said. After they were married, my mother wouldn't act again. Neither would Dan. He was always the director. She was always the prompter. My mother had a good voice for a prompter, quiet but clear. All those singing lessons were good for that, I guess. Her one role, and it was a starring role, was in Angel Street. It was so long ago I can't remember the names of the characters or anything about the actual sets for the play. The Gravesend Players used the town hall, and sets were never very specially attended to there. What I remember is the movie that was made from Angel Street. It was called Gaslight, and I've seen it several times. My mother had the Ingrid Bergman part. She was the wife who was being driven insane by her villainous husband, and Dan was the villain. He was the Charles Boyer character. If you know the story, although Dan and my mother were cast as husband and wife, there is little love evidenced between them on stage. It was the only time or place I ever saw Dan be hateful to my mother. Dan tells me that there are still people in Gravesend who give him evil looks because of that Charles Boyer role he played. They look at him as if he hit that long-ago foul ball, and as if he meant to. And only once in that production, it was actually in dress rehearsal, did my mother wear the red dress. It might have been the evening when she is all dressed up to go to the theater, or somewhere, with her awful husband, but he has hidden the painting and accuses her of hiding it, and he makes her believe that she's hidden it too. And then he banishes her to her room and doesn't let her go out at all. Or maybe it was when they go out to a concert and he finds his watch in her purse. He has put it there, but he makes her break down and plead with him to believe her in front of all those snooty people. Anyway, my mother was supposed to wear the red dress in just one scene, and it was the only scene in the play where she was simply terrible. She couldn't leave the dress alone. She plucked imaginary lint off it. She kept staring at herself as if the cleavage of the dress all by itself had suddenly plunged a foot. She never stopped itching around, as if the material of the dress made her skin crawl. Owen and I saw every production of Angel Street. We saw all of Dan's plays, both the Academy plays and the amateur theatricals of the Gravesend Players. But Angel Street was one of the few productions that we saw every showing of. To watch my mother on stage, and to watch Dan being awful to her,
was such a riveting lie. It was not the play that interested us. It was what a lie it was. That Dan was awful to my mother. That he meant her harm. That was fascinating. Owen and I always knew everyone in all the productions of the Gravesend Players. Mrs. Walker, the ogre of our Episcopal Sunday School, played the flirtatious maid in Angel Street, the Angela Lansbury character, if you can believe it. Owen and I couldn't. Mrs. Walker acting like a tart? Mrs. Walker being vulgar? We kept expecting her to shout, "Owen, Meanie, you get down from up there! You get back to your seat!" And she wore a French maid's costume with a very tight skirt and black, patterned stockings, so that every Sunday thereafter Owen and I would search in vain for her legs. It was such a surprise to see Mrs. Walker's legs, and even more of a surprise to discover that she had pretty legs. The good guy role in Angel Street, the Joseph Cotton part, I call it, was played by our neighbor, Mr. Fish. Owen and I knew that he was still in mourning over the untimely death of Sagamore. The horror of the diaper truck disaster on Front Street was still visible in the pained expression with which he followed my mother's every movement on stage. Mr. Fish was not exactly Owen's and my idea of a hero, but Dan Needham, with his talent for casting and directing the rankest amateurs, must have been inspired, in the case of Mr. Fish, to tap our neighbor's sorrow and anger over Sagamore's encounter with the diaper truck. Anyway, after the dress rehearsal of Angel Street, it was back to the closet with the red dress, except for those many occasions when Owen put it on the dummy. He must have felt especially challenged by my mother's dislike of that dress. It always looked terrific on the dummy. I tell all this only to demonstrate that Owen was as familiar with that dummy as I was. But he was not familiar with it at night. He was not accustomed to the semi-darkness of my mother's room when she was sleeping, when the dummy stood over her, that unmistakable body in profile, in perfect silhouette. That dummy stood so still, it appeared to be counting my mother's breaths. One night at 80 Front Street, when Owen lay in the other twin bed in my room, we were a long while falling asleep because, down the hall, Lydia had a cough. Just when we thought she was over a particular fit, or she had died, she would start up again. When Owen woke me up, I had not been asleep for very long. I was in the grips of such a deep and recent sleep that I couldn't make myself move. I felt as if I were lying in an extremely plush coffin, and my pallbearers were holding me down, although I was doing my best to rise from the dead.
"I feel sick," Owen was saying.
"Are you going to throw up?" I asked him, but I couldn't move. I couldn't even open my eyes.
"I don't know," he said. "I think I have a fever."
"Go tell my mother," I said.
"It feels like a rare disease,"
Owen said. "Go tell my mother," I repeated. I listened to him bump into the desk chair. I heard my door open and close. I could hear his hands brushing against the wall of the hall. I heard him pause with his hand trembling on my mother's doorknob. He seemed to wait there for the longest time. Then I thought, he's going to be surprised by the dummy. I thought of calling out, "Don't be startled by the dummy standing there. It looks weird in that funny light." But I was sunk in my coffin of sleep and my mouth was clamped shut. I waited for him to scream. That's what Owen would do, I was sure. There would be a blood-curdling wail,
"Ah!"
And the entire household would be awake for hours. Or else, in a fit of bravery, Owen would tackle the dummy and wrestle it to the floor. But while I was imagining the worst of Owen's encounter with the dummy, I realized he was back in my room, beside my bed, pulling my hair.
"Wake up," But be quiet, he whispered. Your mother is not alone. Someone strange is in her room. Come see. I think it's an angel.
An angel? I said.
Shh.
Now I was wide awake and eager to see him make a fool of himself, and so I said nothing about the dummy. I held his hand and went with him through the hall to my mother's room. Owen was shivering.
How do you know it's an angel? I whispered.
So we stealthily crept into my mother's room, crawling on our bellies like snipers in search of cover, until the whole picture of her bed, her body in an inverted question mark, and the dummy standing beside her was visible. After a while, Owen said,
It's gone. It must have seen me the first time.
I pointed innocently at the dummy.
What's that?
I whispered.
That's the dummy, you idiot,
Owen said.
The angel was on the other side of the bed.
I touched his forehead. He was burning up.
You have a fever, Owen, I said. I saw an angel, he said.
Is that you, boys? My mother asked sleepily.
Owen has a fever, I said. He feels sick.
Come here, Owen, my mother said, sitting up in bed. He went to her, and she felt his forehead and told me to get him an aspirin and a glass of water.
Owen saw an angel, I said.
Did you have a nightmare, Owen? My mother asked him as he crawled into bed beside her. Owen's voice was muffled in the pillows.
Not exactly, he said.
When I returned with the water and the aspirin, my mother had fallen asleep with her arm around Owen. With his protrusive ears spread on the pillow and my mother's arm across his chest, he looked like a butterfly trapped by a cat. He managed to take the aspirin and drink the water without disturbing my mother, and he handed the glass back to me with a stoical expression.
I'm going to stay here, he said bravely. In case it comes back.
He looked so absurd, I couldn't look at him.
I thought you said it was an angel, I whispered. What harm would an angel do? I don't know what kind of angel it was, he whispered.
And my mother stirred in her sleep. She tightened her grip around Owen, which must have simultaneously frightened and thrilled him. And I went back to my room alone. From what nonsense did Owen Meany discern what he would later call a
pattern
from his feverish imagination? Years later, when he would refer to
that fated baseball,
I corrected him too impatiently. That accident, you mean, I said. It made him furious when I suggested that anything was an accident, especially anything that had happened to him. On the subject of predestination, Owen Meany would accuse Calvin of bad faith. There were no accidents. There was a reason for that baseball, just as there was a reason for Owen being small and a reason for his voice. In Owen's opinion, he had
interrupted an angel.
He had
disturbed an angel at work.
He had
upset the scheme of things.
I realize now that he never thought he saw a guardian angel. He was quite convinced, especially after
that fated baseball,
that he had interrupted the angel of death, although he did not, at the time, delineate the plot of this divine narrative to me. I know that's what he believed. He, Owen Meany, had interrupted the angel of death at her holy work. She had reassigned the task. She gave it to him. How could these fantasies become so monstrous and so convincing to him? My mother was too sleepy to take his temperature, but it's a fact that he had a fever, and that his fever led him to a night in my mother's bed, in her arms. And wouldn't his excitement to find himself there with her, not to mention his fever, have contributed to his readiness to remain wide-eyed and wide-awake, alert for the next intruder, be it angel or ghost or hapless family member? I think so. Several hours later, there came to my mother's room the second fearful apparition. I say fearful because Owen was, at that time, afraid of my grandmother. He must have sensed her distaste for the granite business. I had left the light on in my mother's bathroom and the door to her bathroom open into the hall, and worse, I had left the cold water tap running when I'd fixed Owen a glass of water for his aspirin. My grandmother always claimed she could hear the electric meter counting each kilowatt. As soon as it was dark, she followed my mother through the house, turning off the lights that my mother had turned on. And this night, in addition to her sensing that a light had been left on, grandmother heard the water running, either the pump in the basement or the cold water tap itself. Finding my mother's bathroom in such reckless abandon, grandmother proceeded to my mother's room. Anxious that my mother was ill, or else indignant with budget-mindedness and determined to point out my mother's carelessness, even if she had to wake her up. Grandmother might have just turned out the light, turned off the water, and gone back to bed, if she hadn't made the mistake of turning the cold water tap the wrong way. She turned it much more forcefully on, dousing herself in a spray of the coldest possible water. The tap had been left running for hours. Thus was her nightgown soaked. She would have to change it. This must have inspired her to wake my mother. Not only had electricity and water been a wasting, but here grandmother was, soaked to the skin in her efforts to put a stop to all this escaping energy. I would guess, therefore, that her manner, upon entering my mother's room, was not calm. And although Owen was prepared for an angel, he might have expected that even the angel of death would appear in a serene fashion. My grandmother, dripping wet, her usually flowing nightgown plastered to her gaunt, hunched body, her hair arrayed in its nightly curlers, her face thickly creamed, the lifeless color of the moon, burst into my mother's room. It was days before Owen could tell me what he thought. When you scare off the angel of death, the divine plan calls for the kind of angels you can't scare away. They even call you by name.
Tabitha?
My grandmother said.
Ah!
Owen Meany screamed so terribly that my grandmother could not catch her breath. Beside my mother on the bed, she saw a tiny demon spring bolt upright, propelled by such a sudden and unreal force that my grandmother imagined the little creature was preparing to fly. My mother appeared to levitate beside him. Lydia, who still had both her legs, leaped from her bed and ran straight into her dresser drawers. For days, she would display her bruised nose. Sagamore, who was a short time away from his appointment with the diaper truck, woke up Mr. Fish with his barking. Throughout the neighborhood, the lids of trash cans clattered as cats and raccoons made good their escape from Owen Meany's alarm. A small segment of Gravesend must have rolled over in their beds, imagining that the angel of death had clearly come for someone.
Tabitha?
My grandmother said the next day. I think it is most strange and improper that you should allow that little devil to sleep in your bed.
He had a fever, my mother said, and I was very sleepy.
He has something more serious than a fever all the time, my grandmother said. He acts and sounds as if he's possessed.
You find fault with everyone who isn't absolutely perfect, my mother said.
Owen thought he saw an angel, I explained to grandmother.
He thought I was an angel?
Grandmother asked.
I told you he was possessed.
Owen is an angel, my mother said.
He is no such thing, my grandmother said. He is a mouse, the granite mouse.
When Mr. Fish saw Owen and me on our bicycles, he waved us over to him. He was pretending to mend a loose picket on his fence, but he was really just watching our house,
waiting for someone to come down the driveway.
"Hello, boys," he said. "That was some hullabaloo last night. I suppose you heard it."
Owen shook his head.
"I heard Sagamore barking," I said.
"No, no, before that," Mr. Fish said. "I mean, did you hear what made him bark? Such cries, such a yell, a real hullabaloo."
Sometime after she'd managed to catch her breath, Grandmother had cried out, too. And, of course, Lydia had cried out as well, after she'd collided with her dresser drawers. Owen said later that my grandmother had been wailing like a banshee. But there had been nothing of a caliber comparable to Owen's scream.
"Owen thought he saw an angel,"
I explained to Mr. Fish.
"It didn't sound like a very nice angel, Owen," Mr. Fish said.
"Well, actually," Owen admitted, "I thought Mrs. Wheelwright was a ghost."
"Ah, that explains everything," Mr. Fish said sympathetically.
Mr. Fish was as afraid of my grandmother as Owen was, at least regarding all matters concerning the zoning laws and the traffic on Front Street. He was extremely deferential to her. What a phrase that is. That explains everything. I know better than to think that anything explains everything today. Later, of course, I would tell Dan Needham the whole story, including Owen's belief regarding his interruption of the Angel of Death and how he was assigned that angel's task. But one of the things I failed to notice about Owen was how exact he was, how he meant everything literally, which is not a usual feature of the language of children. For years, he would say,
"I will never forget your grandmother, wailing like a banshee."
But I paid no attention. I could hardly remember Grandmother making much of a ruckus. What I remembered was Owen's scream. Also, I thought it was just an expression, wailing like a banshee, and I couldn't imagine why Owen remembered my grandmother's commotion with such importance. I must have repeated what Owen said to Dan Needham, because years later, Dan asked me, "Did Owen say your grandmother was a banshee?" "He said she was wailing like a banshee," I explained. Dan got out the dictionary then. He was clucking his tongue and shaking his head and laughing to himself, saying, "That boy, what a boy. Brilliant, but preposterous." And that was the first time I learned, literally, what a banshee was. A banshee, in Irish folklore, is a female spirit whose wailing is a sign that a loved one will soon die. Dan Needham was right, as usual. Brilliant, but preposterous. That was such an apt description of the granite mouse. That was exactly what I thought Owen Meany was. Brilliant, but preposterous. As time went on, as you shall see, maybe not so preposterous. It appeared to our town, and to us wheelwrights ourselves, a strange reversal in my mother's character that she should conduct a 4-year courtship with Dan Needham before consenting to marry him. As my Aunt Martha would say, my mother hadn't waited 5 minutes to have the fling that led to me. But perhaps that was the reason. If her own family and all of Gravesend had suspicions regarding my mother's morals, regarding the general ease with which, they might assume, she could be talked into anything, my mother's lengthy engagement to Dan Needham certainly showed them all a thing or two. Because it was obvious, from the start, that Dan and Mother were in love. He was devoted. She dated no one else. They were engaged within a few months, and it was clear to everyone how much I liked Dan. Even my grandmother, who was ever alert for what she feared was her wayward daughter's proclivity to jump into things, was impatient with my mother to set a date for the wedding. Dan Needham's personal charm, not to mention the speed with which he became a favorite in the Gravesend Academy community, had quickly won my grandmother over. Grandmother was not won over quickly as a rule, not by anyone. Yet she became infatuated with the magic Dan wrought upon the amateurs at the Gravesend Players, so much so that she accepted a part in Mom's The Constant Wife. She was the regal mother of the deceived wife, and she proved to have the perfect frivolous touch for drawing-room comedy. She was a model of the kind of sophistication we could all do well without. She even discovered a British accent, with no prodding from Dan, who was no fool, and fully realized that a British accent lay never very deeply concealed in the bosom of Harriet Wheelwright. It simply wanted an occasion to bring it out.
"I hate giving straight answers to a straight question," Grandmother, as Mrs. Culver said imperiously and completely in character.
And at another memorable moment, commenting on her son-in-law's affair with her daughter's greatest friend, she rationalized,
"If John is going to deceive Constance, it's nice it should be somebody we all know."
Well, Grandmother was so marvelous, she brought the house down. It was a grand performance, rather wasted, in my opinion, on poor John and Constance, who were drearily played by a somewhat sheepish Mr. Fish, our dog-loving neighbor, and a regular choice of Dan's, and by the tyrannical Mrs. Walker, whose legs were her sexiest feature, and they were almost completely covered in the long dresses appropriate to this drawing-room comedy. Grandmother, who was rendered coy with false modesty, said simply that she had always had a special understanding of 1927, and I don't doubt it. She would have been a beautiful young woman then. "And your mother," Grandmother told me, "would have been younger than you." So why did Dan and my mother wait 4 years? If there were arguments, if they were sorting out some differences of opinion, I never saw or heard them. Having been so improper as to have me and never explain me, was Mother simply being overly proper the second time around? Was Dan wary of her? He never seemed wary. Was I the problem? I used to wonder. But I loved Dan, and he gave me every reason to feel that he loved me. I know he loved me. He still does.
"Is it about children, Tabitha?"
my grandmother asked one evening at dinner, and Lydia and I sat at attention to hear the answer.
"I mean, does he want them? Do you not want another? Or is it the other way around? I don't think you should trouble yourself about having or not having children, Tabitha, not if it costs you such a lovely, devoted man."
"We're just waiting, to be sure," my mother said.
"Good heavens, you must be sure by now," Grandmother said impatiently. "Even I'm sure, and Johnny's sure. Aren't you sure, Lydia?" Grandmother asked.
"Sure, I'm sure," Lydia said.
"Children are not the issue," my mother said. "There is no issue.
People have joined the priesthood in less time than it takes you to get married," Grandmother said to my mother.
As for joining the priesthood, that was a favorite expression of Harriet Wheelwright's. It was always made in connection with some insupportable foolishness, some self-created difficulty, some action as inhuman as it was bizarre. Grandmother meant the Catholic priesthood, yet I know that one of the things that upset her about the possibility of Mother's moving herself and me to the Episcopal Church was that Episcopalians had priests and bishops, and even low Episcopalians were much more like Catholics than like Congregationalists, in her opinion. A good thing. Grandmother never knew much about Anglicans. In their long courtship, Dan and my mother attended both the congregational and the Episcopal services, as if they were conducting a 4-year theological seminar in private, and my introduction to the Episcopal Sunday School was also gradual. At my mother's prompting, I attended several classes before Dan and my mother were married, as if Mother already knew where we were headed. What was also gradual was how my mother finally stopped going to Boston for her singing lessons. I never had a hint that Dan was the slightest bothered by this ritual,
although I recall my grandmother asking my mother if Dan objected to her spending one night a week in Boston.
Why should he?
My mother asked. The answer, which was not forthcoming, was as obvious to my grandmother as it was to me, that the most likely candidate for the unclaimed position of my father and my mother's mystery lover was that famous singing teacher. But neither my grandmother nor I dared to postulate this theory to my mother, and Dan Needham was clearly untroubled by the ongoing singing lessons and the ongoing one night away. Or else Dan possessed some reassuring piece of knowledge that remained a secret from my grandmother and me.
"Your father is not a singing teacher,"
Owen Meany told me matter-of-factly.
"That would be too obvious."
"This is a real-life story, Owen," I said. "It's not a mystery novel."
In real life, I meant, there was nothing written that the missing father couldn't be.
"Obvious."
But I didn't really think it was the singing teacher either. He was only the most likely candidate because he was the only candidate my grandmother and I could think of.
"If it's him, why make it a secret?"
Owen asked.
"If it's him, wouldn't your mother see him more than once a week? Or not at all?"
Anyway, it was far-fetched to think that the singing teacher was the reason my mother and Dan didn't get married for 4 years. And so I concluded what Owen Meany would call
too obvious,
that Dan was holding out for more information concerning me and that my mother wasn't providing it. For wouldn't it be reasonable of Dan to want to know the story of who my father was? And I know that is a story my mother wouldn't have yielded to Dan. But Owen rebuked me for this idea, too.
"Don't you see how much Dan loves your mother?"
he asked me.
"He loves her as much as we do. He would never force her to tell him anything."
I believe that now. Owen was right. It was something else. That 4-year delay of the obvious. Dan came from a very high-powered family. They were doctors and lawyers, and they disapproved of Dan for not completing a more serious education. To have started out at Harvard and not gone on to law school, not gone on to medical school, this was criminal laziness. Dan came from a family very keen about going on. They disapproved of him ending up as a mere prep school teacher and of his indulging his hobby of amateur theatrical performances. They believed these frivolities were unworthy of a grown-up's interest. They disapproved of my mother, too. And that was the end of Dan having any more to do with them. They called her the divorcee. I guess no one in the Needham family had ever been divorced. And so that was the worst thing you could say about a woman, even worse than calling my mother what she really was, an unwed mother. Perhaps an unwed mother sounded merely hapless, whereas a divorcee implied intent, a woman who was out to snare their dear underachiever, Dan. I don't remember much about meeting Dan's family. At the wedding, they chose not to mingle. My grandmother was outraged that there were people who actually dared to condescend to her, to treat her like some provincial fuss budget. I recall that Dan's mother had an acid tongue, and that when introduced to me, she said, "So this is the child." And then there followed a period of time in which she scrutinized my face for any telltale indication of the race of my missing male ancestor, I would guess. But that's all I remember. Dan refused to have anything further to do with them. I cannot think that they played any role at all in the 4-year engagement. And what with all the comparing and contrasting of a theological nature, there was no end of religious approval for matching Dan and my mother. There was, in fact, double approval. The Congregationalists and the Episcopalians appeared to be competing for the privilege of having Dan and my mother come worship with them. In my opinion, it should have been no contest.
Granted, I was happy to have the opportunity to lift Owen up in the air at Sunday school, but that was the beginning and the end to any advantage the Episcopalians had over the Congregationalists. There were not only those differences I've already mentioned, of an atmospheric and architectural nature, together with those ecclesiastical differences that made the Episcopal service much more Catholic than the Congregational service.
Catholic with a big C,
as Owen would say. But there were also vast differences between the Reverend Lewis Merrill, whom I liked, and the Reverend Dudley Wiggin, the rector of the Episcopal Church, who was a bumpkin of boredom. To compare these two ministers as dismissively as I did, I confess I was drawing on no small amount of snobbery inherited from Grandmother Wheelwright. The Congregationalists had pastors. The Reverend Lewis Merrill was our pastor. If you grow up with that comforting word, it's hard to accept rectors. The Episcopal Church had rectors. The Reverend Dudley Wiggin was the rector of Christ Church, Gravesend. I shared my grandmother's distaste for the word rector. It sounded too much like rectum to be taken seriously. But it would have been hard to take the Reverend Dudley Wiggin seriously if he'd been a pastor. Whereas the Reverend Mr. Merrill had heeded his calling as a young man, he had always been in and of the church, the Reverend Mr. Wiggin was a former airline pilot. Some difficulty with his eyesight had forced his early retirement from the skies, and he had descended to our wary town with a newfound fervor, the zeal of the convert, giving him the healthy but frantic appearance of one of those elder citizens who persist in entering vigorous sporting competitions in the over-50 category. Whereas Pastor Merrill spoke an educated language, he'd been an English major at Princeton,